on her head, and three others pulled out just the banner, while the staff of the DNC encouraged everybody to raise their signs as high as possible to block just a simple banner. So if we are fighting fascism, what are we doing? And the convention center.
Nadja, we're going to give you the last word. And actually, I'd like to know if any of you want to share with whether you are going to support Kamala Harris in November, what your thoughts are, what your bar is.
So Kamala Harris has to decide if she wants me to support her, because every vote has to be earned. That's been the position of the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party has taken the Muslim vote, even the African-American vote, for granted for a number of years. Because what are we going to support, a Muslim ban? But we have to decide as a community how we're going to decide. And so 80% of the Muslim community, even higher number, depending on which state you live in, are against the Biden administration and are very much against supporting the Democratic Party. And so if we look at that, I mean, I live in a red state, so it's hard for my vote to have that much of an impact, but it's going to really have an impact.
Liana?
So
we have 10 seconds.
Sure, I plan to vote for Harris, okay, because I don't want Trump. But that's the only reason. I'm not really voting for Harris. I'm voting against Trump.
And Assam?
I'm a proud Democratic Party member, but Vice President needs to earn my vote.
We're going to leave it there. I want to thank you all for being with us. Assam Barai, a Connecticut delegate. Liana Sharon, a Michigan.
You're listening
delegate.
To KBOO Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and the International Travel Group. KBOO Community Radio and ITG are organizing a journey to Cuba, December 14th to the 21st. It is a guided exchange of music, history, and landscapes. ITG supports KBOO's mission of fostering community through diverse voices. More information at kboo.fm/Cuba.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the ACLU of Oregon sues the city of Medford for surveilling progressive groups. The Multnomah County Sheriff will book people accused of violating Portland's camping ban after all. And in environmental news, the invasive emerald ash borer beetle has been found in more Oregon counties. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 20th, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. The ACLU of Oregon is suing the Medford Police Department for illegally spying on people. Public records obtained by Information for Public Use showed Medford police collected and stored intel on progressive groups and events with no suspicion of criminal activity. That included a drive-in movie at the YMCA as part of a Juneteenth celebration. The suit is filed on behalf of multiple progressive groups from the area, including the Rogue Valley Pepper Shakers and Stabbin' Wagon, and an individual, Melissa Jones. The ACLU says this is a violation of Oregon State Law 181A250. That law prohibits police from collecting or maintaining information about political, religious, or social views and associations or activities of people who are not reasonably suspected of criminal activity. Torin McKnight is a co-founder of the Rogue Valley Pepper Shakers, one of the groups in the lawsuit. McKnight said in a press release, quote, "The Medford police are monitoring people like me because of what we care about, not for anything related to crime. Other activists, advocates, and organizations who support Black, Brown, and queer lives, see abortion as a healthcare right, care for the unhoused, the environment, and practice harm reduction, could be subject to this illegal invasion of privacy, too." End quote. The lawsuit is seeking injunctive relief. They want the city of Medford to admit to violating Oregon state law in collecting those records, and going forward, they want the Medford police to be prohibited from keeping information on them or their activities. Multnomah County Sheriff Nicole Morrissey O'Donnell will book people arrested for violating Portland's camping ban into jail for the next 120 days. This represents a major change, of course. Just weeks ago, the sheriff said she wouldn't accept people charged with breaking the ordinance into county jail. At the time, she said, quote, "Arresting and booking our way out of the housing crisis is not a constructive solution," end quote. the city ordinance restricts where unhoused Portlanders can camp outside. If a person refuses to accept shelter when offered by police, they can face arrest or a fine. The sheriff and mayor, Ted Wheeler, issued a joint statement this morning saying sheriff's deputies will book people into jail after all. That's for the next 120 days. Sheriff Morrissey O'Donnell says that will allow her to identify if the approach is, quote, effective and sustainable. The sheriff says that people who break the ordinance will be fingerprinted and their mugshots taken, but they won't likely be kept in jail. The ordinance does allow for that, however. The 120-day enforcement period ends in mid-December, just before the new mayor, council, and form of government will take over in Portland. It's also when the new Multnomah County District Attorney takes office. Three more Willamette Valley counties have found the invasive emerald ash borer beetle threatening their trees. It's notable that the beetles were found far from the previously known infestations in Washington County. Marion, Yamhill, and Clackamas counties have found the beetle, which can be seriously damaging to ash trees. Land managers have removed dozens of infested trees, and they've treated nearby healthy trees with a pesticide to protect against the beetle. They have also hung sticky purple traps on tree trunks to help track the bugs. They found beetles in the glue trap in July. Emerald ash borers have been making their way across the U.S. for years, typically decimating local ash tree populations. The first beetle was detected in Oregon in 2022. KBOO's Althea Billings first reported on the danger of the emerald ash borers in 2023.
The emerald ash borer. It's a green, wood-boring beetle that is responsible for the destruction of tens of millions of ash trees in North America. In June 2022, the beetle was found in Forest Grove, Oregon. That was the furthest west in the continental United States that it's been seen. Michael Spalding is the district manager in Portland at the Davy Tree Expert Company. He explains.
The emerald ash borer gets its name because it's a bright green metallic color. It's an invasive beetle that's killed hundreds of millions of trees all over the U.S., Midwest, East Coast, Southeast, all the way up to Denver. And now it's just across the Rockies and it's here. It decimates these trees typically from the top down, but typically on the warmer side, so you'll probably find signs of the emerald ash borer on the south-facing side of the tree in the canopy. And you'll see thinning and decline fairly rapidly. And these pests move much faster than a bronze birch borer that we've had here for quite a while. They move very fast, and the way that they take apart the tree from the inside, they make them very brittle, very dangerous, and hard to remove once it's about a 30% canopy dieback. And they're very, very fast and invasive.
Dr. Barry Lyons is a research scientist at the Great Lakes Forestry Center. He explained to Natural Resources Canada how the emerald ash borer kills ash trees.
The eggs laid on the trunk of the tree under a bark chip or in a bark crevice. The tiny larva, when it emerges from that egg, chews its way down through the bark to the surface of the wood. So it occurs in that interface between the wood and the bark, and the larva starts to form a gallery there. Well, that tissue in that area is very important for transporting nutrients up and down the tree and transporting water up the tree. And so as the larva feed, they damage some of those vessels that transport the fluids, and that eventually girdles the tree and causes the death of the tree.
There are signs that an ash tree has been infested with the emerald ash borer. Experts point to a thinning crown of the tree, long shoots growing from the trunk or branches, small D-shaped holes in the bark where the beetles emerge from, and S-shaped holes under the bark that are filled with a fine sawdust. All of these are signs that the emerald ash borer is impacting the tree. Spalding says the emerald ash borer has decimated tree populations east of the Rocky Mountains, and arborists don't yet know how the native Oregon ash will fare against this threat.
We are going to find out how susceptible the native Oregon ash is. Those are planted all over. A lot of the green ash trees are typically planted as street trees and in planters and in like parking lots. You find those quite a lot on the street. So I lived in Chicago for 3 years during the hard thick of the ash pandemic when this was going on as a consulting arborist, and it was really hard to convey the importance of treating the trees prior to them being infested. And after it got about a 20% canopy dieback, it's not worth treating anymore and should be removed. There was a lot of money spent with municipalities. There was a lot of heartache with prized trees in people's properties that had to be removed. It decimates every ash tree in the area.
The emerald ash borer is native to northeastern Asia, and ash trees there co-evolved with the beetle to have stronger defenses. Scientists believe the beetle was brought to North America around 2002 in wood packaging from Asia. Climate change has also made these emerald ash borer infestations worse, Spalding explains.
Climate change stresses out the trees with our longer, hotter, drier summers. And with a stressed tree, you have a weakened immune system, just like a human being. It's more difficult for the tree to fight off the pests. And you also see multiple seasons of these pests. So instead of having one generational cycle, you'll have three or four generational cycles because they have a longer, hotter, drier, livable season for them.
People can act now to protect local ash trees from the emerald ash borer beetle, Spalding says. But it's important not to wait until the beetle has already started in on the tree.
Well, the most important thing you can do is keep the health of the tree boosted. So you need to be doing deep root treatments and bringing nutrients to the tree, as well as you have to be treating the tree with an insecticide, an internal insecticide that's targeted for the emerald ash borer. It's a probe about 8 inches long, and you step it down, and it's a high-pressure injection that goes in deep into the soil, all around the root flares, the soil profile, all beneath the canopy of the tree. And if they're not treated, it's almost a guarantee that if the tree's not treated, it will be taken out.
For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
Officials are considering implementing a wood quarantine in the counties where the beetles have been found, like there has been in Washington County. They say Oregonians shouldn't move firewood and woody material across the state, especially in Washington, Marion, Yamhill, and Clackamas counties. The Oregon Department of Forestry says they'll work to alert landowners of the signs of an infestation. A quarantine could help, but time is needed for the other parts of the state to prepare and protect their trees. President Biden gets a standing ovation on an emotional first night of the Democratic National Convention. In the streets, protests call for ending the Gaza war, and an Arizona delegate calls a win for Harris and Waltz a victory for all. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks. We're live from the Democratic National Convention at the United Center in Chicago and are tracking the 2024 election process.
It's been the honor of my lifetime to serve as your president. I love the job, but I love my country more. I love my country more, and we need to preserve our democracy.
President Joe Biden received an emotional reception speaking to the first night of the DNC. He described a long list of his policy wins, but also shared confidence in Vice President Kamala Harris as the Democratic nominee. Biden also says he holds no resentment towards those who pushed him to drop out of the race a month ago. Many delegates, like Silvia Lagos from Texas, say the Democratic Party is grateful to Biden for putting America above his own ambition.
I think he sacrificed what he really wanted for the betterment of the country, and because of that, we love him even more.
But in the streets outside, the intense emotions are different. Thousands of protesters are angrily calling for a ceasefire and an Israel arms blockade. White House says Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has agreed to ceasefire terms, but neither Netanyahu nor Hamas have confirmed the deal. New York progressive Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says Harris should get some credit.
She is working tirelessly to secure a ceasefire in Gaza and bringing hostages home.
More than 40,000 Palestinians and 1,000 Israelis have died since the war started. The DNC crowd chanted "Lock him up" about former President Donald Trump during former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's speech, a reference to the "lock her up" chants of 2016 Trump rallies. Clinton says Trump has made his own kind of history.
The first person to run for president with 34 felony convictions.
New polling shows Harris is leading Trump by 4 points among registered voters and 6 points among likely voters. But Harris says she's still the underdog and will run like one. California Democratic Party Chairman Rusty Hicks says it's going to be close, up and down the ballot.
In swing states, they will be decided by a handful of votes. In order to retake the House of Representatives, we've got to win seats in California. Those seats will be won by a handful of votes.
Arizona's Maricopa County continues to be the heart of many election conspiracy theories. Carl Gentles is a Democratic delegate from the county. He says it's good for democracy to see Harris getting Republican support.
We see people on the Republican side reaching across and saying, we know and we want to support Vice President Harris. It's because they realize that she's in it for everybody. She's in it for Democrats, Republicans, and Independents.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. We'll be back tomorrow for day two of the DNC. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather will be clear with some clouds later in the night, with an overnight low of 56 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 75. Today in history, in 1866, President Andrew Johnson formally declares the end of the American Civil War. The quote of the day is from American neuropsychologist and Nobel Prize winner Roger Wolcott Sperry, who was born this day in 1913. He said, quote, "Prior to the advent of brain, there was no color and no sound in the universe, nor was there any flavor or aroma, and probably rather little sense and no feeling or emotion. Before brains, the universe was also free of pain and anxiety." Minnesota Governor and Vice Presidential nominee Tim Walz addressed the DNC Native Caucus meeting on day one. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Native Americans are among those gathered in the Windy City for the Democratic National Convention to discuss tribal priorities with elected officials. National Native News anchor Antonia Gonzalez reports from Chicago.
Native people from across the country gathered in a packed room for a Native American caucus meeting. The meeting is among 33 council and caucus meetings the DNC is hosting this week. Attendees at the Monday morning meeting included convention delegates, tribal leaders, and community members. It began with a prayer and land acknowledgement. Panel discussions were paused as special guests made appearances, including DNC Chair Jamie Harrison and New Jersey Senator Cory Booker. The room was overwhelmed with excitement when Minnesota Governor and Vice Presidential hopeful Tim Walz walked in.
I hope this is a group that knows a little bit about us, because there's something in Minnesota we take very seriously, and that's tribal sovereignty.
Walz, in brief remarks, acknowledged tribal sovereignty and the 11 Native nations in his state. Walz says tribal consultation is key when addressing Indian country issues, including economic development, education, and environmental and health issues. Before exiting, Walz recognized Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, who's White Earth Nation. He says if the Harris-Walz ticket wins in November, it's also a win for Flanagan, who would become governor. DNC Delegate for Arizona and Gila River Indian Community Governor Stephen Roe Lewis is among those excited about both the Harris-Walz ticket and Flanagan's next possible leadership role.
Of course, she knows firsthand how important tribal sovereignty is, how important it is for that state-tribal partnership as well. That if we elect Governor Tim Walz as our next vice president, Vice President Kamala Harris as our next president, but she would be the first Native governor of a state and also the first female governor of the state of Minnesota. It's amazing.
The Native American Caucus continued with panel discussions, including on the topic of the Native Vote 2024. The caucus will meet again on Wednesday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
As the school year approaches, one Indigenous-led organization is handing out backpacks to Rapid City kids. As SDPB's Lee Strubinger reports, Indian collective officials say they distributed more than 2,000 backpacks last Friday.
The line for families seeking backpacks for the upcoming school year wrapped around the Journey Museum parking lot near downtown Rapid City. This is the fourth year in a row Indian Collective has handed out school supplies to Native children before school starts. Despite handing out thousands of backpacks, the organization ran out of supplies to those still standing in line. Nick Tilson is the CEO of NDN Collective. He says the backpack giveaway has grown every year.
A lot of people who have privilege and have resources don't realize that going back to school is a good thing, but it's also a very expensive thing. But we've also noticed thousands of people coming here and the community being really grateful for it, and really it helping reduce stress for families too.
Tilson says NDN Collective is focused on education for Native children to combat the school-to-prison pipeline. The group is also backing the Ocheti Chacoan Community Academy, a private school founded in Lakota language, culture, and spirituality. Mary Bowman heads the school, which is heading into its third year.
In November, we will be out on the land where our school will eventually be built, our permanent building. It's something that we are looking forward to doing, and I know our kids are super excited to be in our own building because that allows us to do more things, like after-school programming, summer programming for our students and families.
The academy has been operating in churches around the city. The new facility is in development in North Rapid City. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger.
And I'm Brian Bull, hosting from KLCC in Eugene, Oregon.
A new Accountable.us report exposes how producers of the first 10 medications up for price negotiation with Medicare have exploited patient laws to keep prices high for seniors and other patients. Eric Galatis has more.
As advocacy groups take a victory lap for moving lawmakers to finally allow Medicare to negotiate lower prices for 10 widely used medicines, a new report details how the makers of those drugs have gouged billions of taxpayer and consumer dollars. Kyle Herrig with the group Accountable.us says drug makers have exploited U.S. patent laws to control prices for decades.
These kind of tactics keep prices high for the consumers and often lead to patients skipping doses, disproportionately affecting lower-income Black and Latin American communities.
Drug makers have routinely paid competitors to delay the introduction of cheaper generic versions of popular drugs. They've also kept prices high by resetting patent protections, by slightly altering a drug to secure a second patent. Drug companies have long argued that high prices are necessary to finance the development of new life-saving medicines. Even though U.S. taxpayers invested nearly $12 billion in the research and development of the drugs negotiated by Medicare, Herrick says pharmaceuticals have also flooded the courts to keep prices high.
So despite taking billions of taxpayer dollars for drug development, these big pharma companies unleashed an army of patent attorneys to keep life-saving medication exclusive and more expensive for seniors and other patients.
U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota worked with groups including AARP to push Congress to allow Medicare to use its purchasing power to bring down drug prices. She says medications don't work if you can't afford them.
It is fine to make profits, but not to the extent that you're actually hurting Americans' health. In the United States of America, no one should be forced to choose between filling their prescriptions or filling their grocery carts.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
The Sentencing Project released a report, Youth Justice by the Numbers, which finds youth crime has been falling for decades. The number of arrests of young people fell more than 80% between 1996 and 2020. The number of youths in juvenile justice facilities has also seen a steep decline over the past 20 years. Brett Pivato reports from Maryland.
A new report shows the rate of juvenile crime has been falling for years, but disparities remain in Maryland and nationwide. The Sentencing Project report shows the number of arrests for people younger than 18 fell more than 80% between 1996 and 2020. The number of young people in juvenile justice facilities on a typical day fell by 75%, from more than 100,000 in the year 2000 to 27,000 in 2022. Study author Josh Rovner says public perception of the crime rate is often tied to hearing about individual crimes.
Whether it's a homicide or a retail theft, that's an upsetting thing to hear. And the value in data is to put those events into context and understand that we have always had problems with public safety as a country. And to understand whether things are getting better or worse is pretty important if you're trying to figure out how to solve them.
The report found Maryland's 2021 placement rate for detained and committed youths was the sixth lowest in the nation. Last September, the Maryland Department of Juvenile Services released released a report finding that despite an increase in youth crime over the prior 2 years, most categories of youth crime in the state, including violent crime, are below pre-pandemic levels and have been in decline for more than a decade. That report also found that youth of color are overrepresented in the Maryland justice system. Robner says that's consistent with his research.
Youth of color are treated more harshly at every point of contact with the justice system. They're more likely to be arrested, and after they've been arrested, they are less likely to be referred to diversionary programs. If they are in fact found accountable for what they did, white youth are more likely to get probation and youth of color are more likely to be incarcerated.
The Department of Juvenile Services found that while youths of color make up 58% of the youth population in the state, DJS intake complaints for youths of color constituted 75% of the total for 2023. For Maryland News Connection, I'm Brett Pivato.
Conservatives' 900-page manifesto, Project 2025, outlines a plan to restructure the U.S. government. Parts of the plan would eliminate several government agencies, such as the Environmental Protection Agency, the Education Department, and the National Weather Service. KBOO reporter Morgan has more on the story.
Environmental groups are concerned that part of Project 2025 calls for closing several federal agencies that political conservatives consider too powerful or unnecessary. There is a particular concern that science-based agencies, particularly those battling climate change, would be eliminated or their functions privatized. David Kiva with the Environmental Defense Fund Action says agencies such as the National Weather Service would be privately operated to make profit instead of providing vital public service.
The idea that you would privatize the National Weather Service doesn't just mean that the quality of the forecast would decline. It also critically means you might not get life or death warning to seek shelter at a time when you really need it.
The Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 is a 900-page plan likely to be adopted if Republicans win control of the government. It would completely restructure operations to align with the right-wing conservative values and replace thousands of civil servants with trained party loyalists. Kiva says the country has a great deal to lose if agencies such as the EPA and the National Weather Service are privatized. He says that the climate change has brought more extreme weather events, year-round wildfires, and a sharp increase in the number of days with extreme heat. Kiva says once public service agencies are lost, they take decades to replace.
Replacing career civil servants with political appointees will significantly undermine the public good done by agencies like the National Weather Service that have worked in the public interest for a very, very long time.
Kiva says the Biden-Harris administration has focused on reducing pollution, developing clean energy, and fighting climate change. He says Project 2025 promotes the goals of groups such as the oil industry and pharmaceuticals that want to eliminate all regulations.
National Weather Service has some of the most sophisticated radar and satellites. It's unclear to me how you would even structure this if the ultimate motive was profit as opposed to furtherance of the public interest.
For KBOO News and Public News Service, I'm Morgan.
NASA satellites can help track wildfires. The imagery and data they generate can give agencies real-time safety alerts. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As the climate warms, extreme wildfires are becoming more common. But scientists are now using data gathered by NASA's Earth observation satellites to help keep people safe.
Earth observations are extremely valuable in detecting and observing and managing wildfires.
Michelle Hawkins works on climate resilience with NASA. Before a fire even sparks, satellites can pinpoint places with a lot of flammable material, like dry vegetation. Land managers can then use that data to plan prescribed burns that reduce the risk of a fire growing out of control. When a wildfire does occur, satellites can also help officials understand how big the blaze is and how it's spreading, so agencies can provide real-time safety alerts.
We have imagery and data and information that can show the fire perimeter so that emergency managers can provide updates to evacuation orders, for example.
And after a wildfire ends, satellites can spot places at a high risk for landslides, which can occur in recently burned areas. So even as the risk of wildfires increases on a warming planet, These eyes in the sky can provide the data officials need to keep people out of harm's way. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Now it's time for The Point Puzzle, a weekly radio puzzle focused on wordplay and logic. As Pearl Stark from KPOV Bend tells us, this week's edition is all about summer fruits and vegetables.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to start with a word that you might be hearing about the night right now. Change an R to an A and L and rearrange to get something else visible at night. Well, the answer is Perseid, which becomes Pleiades. Our winner this week is Brett Yost, who listens to KPOV in Bend, Oregon. You're the man. And Jim Gregory. Navigating by the stars at night. They're navigating by the stars at night. And they're not, not, not. Navigating by the stars at night. They're navigating by the stars at night. For the new puzzle, I'm looking for a summer food crop that phonetically could go in the blank, I blank, I'm married. So again, send me a summer food crop that phonetically can go in the blank, I blank, I'm married. When you have an answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
There's something in my garden so big and orange and round. It started just a little seed when I stuck it in the ground. Now it doesn't look at all like what it did last spring. Hey, won't somebody tell me what the heck you call this thing? Oh, the pumpkin man with the big brown.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of August 19th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 20th, 2020.